Hello, everyone. I'm Camille Nelson-Cotton, and I am the Clinical Director of Transplant and Immunocompromised Host Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital. I will be talking to you today about solid organ and stem cell transplant ID as a boot camp. This is a supplement to the regular IDBR course. I have some disclosures, as you can see on this slide. And what I hope you will learn today is about the type of immunosuppression seen with organ and stem cell transplant, also the timelines of infection and what to expect at which points along the way. I will be discussing a lot about prevention, as good prevention is paramount, and really knowing what they're on for prophylaxis can help you a lot with the differential diagnosis. I will cover various syndromes, talk about diagnostics, which can be challenging in this population, but I do like to encourage diagnostic stewardship, talk about various treatments, and then the latest strategies for prevention, recognition, diagnosis, and treatment using guidelines and best practices. So let's get going. There was, I thought, very interesting data that was published a year ago on the incidence of immunosuppression among US adults. And this was a survey done by the CDC. And interestingly, 6.6% of U.S. adults report being immunocompromised. 4% reported an immunosuppressive condition. Another 4% take immunosuppressive medications, and 2% report both. This is more common in women at about 8% compared to 5% in men. But overall, what's really interesting is that this number has doubled in the past decade since the prior CDC survey back in 2013. So this affects a lot of the population, maybe not as intensely as the transplant ID population, but nonetheless, we do have a growing population of immunocompromised patients, as I'm sure many of you are aware in your day-to-day work. One of the silver linings of the pandemic was that we did develop definitions for the CDC of who has moderate to severe immunocompromise. And as you can see on this list, it includes things like active treatment for solid tumor and hematologic malignancies, people who have received a solid organ transplant and are taking immunosuppressive therapy, people who've had CAR T-cell therapy or stem cell transplants within 2 years of transplants or who aren't taking immunosuppressive therapy, those with moderate or severe primary immunodeficiency or advanced or untreated HIV infection, or, and this is a catch-all category, but does include a lot of patients that we see, active treatment with high-dose steroids, which is greater than or equal to 20 milligrams of prednisone a day, alkylating agents, anti-metabolites, transplant-related immunosuppressive drugs, cancer chemotherapeutic agents classified as severely immunosuppressive, and tumor necrosis factor blockers and other biologic agents that are immunosuppressive or immunomodulatory. So I think that this guidance is helpful in really saying, you know, who's at higher risk for a lot of the opportunistic and other severe infections. Interestingly, this past year, the Infectious Disease Society of America, in developing guidelines for the use of pemivibart, the COVID-19 monoclonal antibody, went on and did further risk stratification, where they actually developed high risk, moderate risk, and lower risk immunocompromised categories. And just to reiterate, the highest risk would be people who've had a stem cell transplant within the past 2 years, people with severe graft versus host disease, or who have hematologic malignancy on therapy, or lung transplant, or those who have fewer than 1% peripheral B cells assessed in the past 6 months. In other words, those getting things like anti-CD20 therapy. And then you can see the different categories for moderate and lower risk. But I think that this is helpful when we're seeing people just thinking about their overall net state of immunosuppression and what their risks may be. In the yellow book, we do include a definition of who is less immunocompromised, which I personally find to be a bit of a relief. So people who've had a stem cell transplant who are now more than 2 years out, not on immunosuppressive therapy and do not have graft versus host disease, people who've had chemotherapy for leukemia, lymphoma, or cancer who are more than 3 months out from their cancer treatment with malignancy in remission, people with well-treated HIV or asplenia or nutritional deficiencies or low-dose steroids such as inhalers or topical steroids. So those are the folks that we don't worry so much about. There's a great concept that was pioneered by one of my mentors at Mass General, Dr. Robert Rubin, and it's the idea of this net state of immunosuppression. And this is something that I calculate on a patient-by-patient basis. So when you're looking at the individual patient, their absolute immunosuppression is a composite of multiple factors, including their disease state. You know, do they have autoimmune disease? Things like lupus greatly enhance immunosuppression. Do they have advanced organ failure? Do they have kidney compromise, liver compromise? All of those things contribute. What comorbidities do they have? Do they have poorly controlled diabetes, obesity, malnutrition, or weight loss? Might they have hypogammaglobulinemia? Do they have viral infections like HIV, CMV, EBV? Do they have an altered microbiome? And we're learning a lot about that, or perhaps advanced age. And we're certainly seeing a different spectrum of infections for people who undergo transplant in their 70s and 80s compared to lower age. And then, of course, we include the exogenous immunosuppression, pre-transplant immunosuppression, induction agents used at the time of transplant, chronic immunosuppression, and then treatment of rejection. But I do think it's important to think about the overall individual patient and add all of these things up into your calculus when you're looking at them. So let's talk about the types of stem cell transplants. So there are both autologous stem cell transplants with a lower risk of infection. And that's where this is, some people say that this technically isn't a transplant because it's the patient's own stem cells are collected before high-dose chemotherapy is given. And then the stem cells are reintroduced after treatment. This allows for a very high-dose chemotherapy that would otherwise kill the bone marrow. But it is a much lower infection risk. Interestingly, in the literature, people often refer to stem cell transplant, and you can't tell which one is which. So it's important to know that autologous is lower risk, and then allogeneic is much higher infection risk. And this is really where we see the problematic issues. This is when there are stem cells from a donor who can be a blood relative or someone who's not related but is a close genetic match. There are haploidentical transplants, which is when stem cells come from a half-matched donor. Cord blood is by umbilical cord blood banking. And then there are things like reduced intensity allogeneic stem cell transplants, which are also called mini transplants or non-myeloablative transplants. And the conditioning treatment has lower, less toxic doses of chemotherapy and radiation. So it's important to actually know the details. And I will say there's a spectrum of what we see for allogeneic stem cell transplant. And I often ask the oncologist, you know, what exactly did they get? What are you anticipating? What are the details? There are a whole raft of protocols out there. So it's important to understand the details and the nuances so that you can understand the net state of immunosuppression and the overall infection risk. Now, if we look back in the U.S., from 2016 through 2020, we did just over 111,000 stem cell transplants. Of that, over 66,000 were autologous stem cell transplants, and then the other about 44,000 were the allogeneic. And you can see it's a mix of HLA matched siblings at 10,000, other related donors at 10,000, and then unrelated but matched at 24,000. So sort of a the majority are autologous, but the higher risk for infection is allogeneic. I really like a timeline and to think about which immune defects are occurring when and when the risk of infection might occur. And this is a lovely chart graphic done by Marcus Pereira and Stephanie Pouch. In our textbook on transplant ID. And so pre-engraftment after stem cell transplant is when you see higher rates of neutropenia, mucositis, and then it goes on in days 30 through 100 are the impaired cellular immunity, and that can even last past 100 days, and then impaired humoral immunity more than 100 days out. Acute GVHD is sort of within the first 50 days after transplant, and then chronic GVHD occurs later. So all of those are significant risk factors, but impact the type of infection we see. You can see that high incidence infections include lots of different bacterial infections in the first 30 days, Also, things like disseminated HSV, Candida, and Aspergillus infections. And then usually starting a little later, after day 30, CMV infection, zoster, adenovirus, and late Aspergillus. And then we tend to see later development of things like pneumocystis, toxoplasmosis, strongyloides, and EBV-associated lymphoproliferative disease. We can see respiratory and enteric viruses at any point. So this is sort of helpful, although certainly rules were meant to be broken, and we do see a lot of variation from this. But this is an overall pretty good schema for you to think about. So what do we see for immunosuppression after allogeneic stem cell transplant? We do, there's the chemotherapy, and chemotherapy can have long-lasting impact on the immune system. And then graft-versus-host disease prophylaxis can include things like tacrolimus and cyclosporin, methotrexate, mycophenolate mofetil, and antithymocyte globulin. If treatment is needed, that often, first line is often methylprednisolone. And then there's often a combination of prophylaxis and treatment used if people really have ongoing either acute or chronic graft-versus-host disease. But it's important to understand what their therapy is and what the rationale is. Again, a good discussion with the oncology team is often helpful. Just to highlight that CAR T-cell therapy does have infectious complications. This CAR T-cell therapy involves lymphocyte engineering to produce CAR T-cells that are directed towards tumor cell antigens, and it can be profoundly immunosuppressive, and patients can develop cytopenias. About a third of patients will have a serious bacterial infection within the first 30 days. Viral respiratory tract infections can be severe, and fungal infection is fortunately uncommon, and so is CMV, so that's quite good. There are a lot of off-target effects that can cause toxicity-related adverse events, things like cytokine release syndrome and immune effector neurotoxicity syndrome. So it's good to be aware of the potential side effects, many of which can mimic infectious disease syndromes. And we often have to rule out infection before we can make an official diagnosis of one of these toxicity-related adverse events. Also to highlight that many people are getting bispecific antibody therapy, and there are a variety of associated infections. You can see that there are patient-related factors as listed here, including age, comorbidities, immune system status, and cytopenias. Things like tumor burden, disease-related factors like tumor burden and refractory illness and disease type, as well as renal dysfunction, can also contribute. And there are a lot of treatment-related factors, including use of steroids, whether they've had an autologous transplant, previous treatment with various immunosuppressive agents, of which there are many now, recent CAR T-cell therapy, et cetera, and then what type of infection history have they had, and then what are they on for prevention? But we do see a lot of issues around bispecific antibodies. Although I will highlight that although there are a lot of infection issues, we have really good, much improved clinical outcomes. So that is wonderful. But there's always a bit of a price to pay with these novel and amazing therapies as far as the risk of infection. Let's switch now to organ transplant. So in 2024, we had our best year ever for organ transplantation, and we did over 48,000 organ transplants in the United States. Since 1988, we have done well over 1 million organ transplants, and many of those patients are still alive. The majority of what we're doing is kidney transplants, followed by liver, followed by heart, and followed by lung. Last year, we did just over 3,300 lung transplants in the U.S., but many of you are seeing these patients in your practices, especially kidney transplant, and many of these patients are leading full and robust lives, which is just wonderful. So common immunosuppression after organ transplant, we usually think about induction. So at the time of transplant, so we often use T-cell depleting agents such as antithymocyte globulin, which is polyclonal, and I always think kind of tries to suck all the lymphocytes out of the system. The goal is to get the lymphocyte count down to zero. Some groups much less commonly use alemtuzumab, also called Campath, and then first older folks or people who are determined to not need robust induction, we use things like IL-2 antagonists such as basiliximab. And some for things like liver transplant, we often just do high dose steroids for induction. Chronic immunosuppression is usually standardly for many organs, a three-drug regimen, including prednisone, tacrolimus, and mycophenolate mofetil. That's pretty standard. Some are using long-acting tacrolimus called Invarsis. Sometimes patients are on cyclosporine, especially if the transplant was done long ago. And then for people who have GI toxicity from mycophenolate mofetil, they're often on a similar agent, but Myfortic, and that can decrease the rate of diarrhea. And some people are on prednisone sparing regimens. But I always, when I see that a transplant patient is not on prednisone, I always double check that no one forgot to include that in their regimen, or that I'm not overlooking anything, because many are on prednisone 5 milligrams a day, and you don't want them to become Addisonian with associated syndrome. So we always make sure that it's either included or specifically not included. There's a very well-honed timeline of infection after organ transplantation. This is a classic publication by my mentor, Jay Fishman. So in the first month after transplant, you know, it's kind of what you would expect, the nosocomial or technical issues associated with a major infection. We also sometimes see donor-derived infection in that first one-month window. Many of the unexpected things, West Nile virus, rabies, Chagas disease, et cetera. And some of the prior colonization situations can result in acute infection. And then in the first 1 to 6 months after transplant, we think about activation of latent infections and also some of the interesting opportunistic infections. But I will say prophylaxis changes everything. So with good prophylaxis, you can really prevent a lot of things. Without prophylaxis, we see things like pneumocystis, disseminated zoster, reactivation hepatitis B, all kinds of things that don't really need to happen because we have good prophylaxis. And then more than 6 months out, we tend to think about standardly community acquired infections, but they can still get some of the, you know, opportunistic unicorns and zebras and whatnot. So you have to have both a standard, like it's probably just a UTI kind of hat on. And then you should also think about, you know, just keep in your mind, is this CMV? Is this pneumocystis? Is this something opportunistic and atypical? So if they don't have a response to standard therapy, or if the syndrome is unusual, put on your thinking cap. So what might be on the boards? Well, I would say that as far as what's trendy, we are all using hepatitis C positive donors these days. About 15% of donors in the New England Organ Bank are hepatitis C positive. So we use these organs from hepatitis C positive donors. We treat the recipient afterwards, and we have pretty much 100% clearance. So this has really become standard of care across all organs. You do need to make sure that you have a good plan for hepatitis C treatment afterwards, that, you know, insurance is on board and all of that. And then we're moving towards using shorter treatment protocols for hepatitis C in this setting. But this is amazing and has really enhanced the organ pool. And patients are actually quite grateful for this. I never thought we'd see such grateful patients for being acutely infected, but fully resolved. So it's pretty amazing. We also have a lot of data on using HIV-positive donors and HIV-positive recipients. This was initially a project spearheaded by Dr. Elmi Muller in Cape Town, South Africa, and she's had multiple publications on this. But overall, there has not been transmission of drug-resistant virus, and the five-year survival, both overall survival and graft survival, is similar to the three-year overall survival and graft survival observed among HIV-positive patients who received an HIV-negative organ, so suggesting non-inferiority and overall really good outcomes. For a long time, we had the HOPE Act in the United States that allowed us to use HIV-positive donors into HIV-positive recipients, this was previously a research situation, but now is moving on to standard of care for abdominal organs, including kidney and liver. But for thoracic organs, those are still under research protocol only. What's been really interesting is about half of the organ donors had false positive HIV testing. And on confirmatory testing, which is done days and days or even weeks after the organ transplant, we actually find out that the donor was definitely HIV negative. So it's a way to use sort of questionable organs, but it's sort of wonderful that we get these HIV, what are actually HIV negative organs for HIV positive people. And those organs would have otherwise been discarded. And just overall outcomes are good. We accelerate the time to transplant with really good outcomes. So this has been a wonderful program that was published in the New England Journal last fall. So let's talk about prevention and prophylaxis for solid organ transplant. So a pre-immune suppression evaluation is key. And I've been doing these for over 20 years at Mass General. We try to see every single patient who's going on the transplant list. We look at vaccines, and update the vaccine status. We screen for latent infections. We make a plan for chronic infections depending on the individual patient details. And we do a lot of education, optimizing diabetes management, stop smoking, stop using inhaled marijuana because of the risk of mold infections, et cetera. And then we help with management around the time of transplant and then longer-term prophylaxis. A good example of the kind of thing we do, we saw a 48-year-old man who was referred for routine pre-kidney transplant evaluation. He was originally from rural El Salvador. He had a positive treponemal antibody. His RPR was positive at 1 to 16. He'd never been treated before. His diagnosis was late-latent syphilis, and he was treated with weekly benzathine penicillin times 3. He had no neurologic symptoms. Strongyloides antibody positive. He had 18% eosinophilia, so we diagnosed him as having indolent strongylodiasis, for which he was given ivermectin daily times 2, wait 2 weeks, and given 2 more doses. He was hepatitis B4 antibody positive, surface antibody negative, so the plan would be our routine protocol, which is to monitor every 3 months after transplant. He had a positive T-spot TB. He had a very high number of spots on both ELISpot panels. He had calcified granulomas on a chest CT. So he was diagnosed with latent tuberculosis and given 9 months of isoniazid with vitamin B6. We did not delay transplant, though. He actually underwent transplant when on treatment for latent TB. He was also positive for Chagas disease. So as per protocol, we did Chagas PCR on a routine basis after transplant, and he did not have reactivation Chagas disease. And he was poorly vaccinated, so we made a plan to update all of his vaccines. That's kind of a routine day in pre-transplant ID clinic. We have a pre-immunosuppression evaluation at Mass General, which is very standard. And this is for, you know, dermatology, rheumatology, et cetera. We test everybody for hepatitis B panel, hepatitis C, HIV, tuberculosis, and then if risk factors, coccidioides, strongyloides, and Chagas disease, but most people don't need that testing. Prior to organ transplant, we broadened that a bit. So we test for hepatitis A, B, and C, HIV, TB, varicella, cytomegalovirus, mumps, measles, rubella, and syphilis, and if risk, coccidioides, strongyloides, and trypanosoma. And then if they are negative, we take the opportunity to vaccinate them against hepatitis A, hepatitis B, varicella, and MMR. And I would emphasize that these days, because there's more measles activity, it's a really important thing to make sure they're up to date on their measles vaccine. I think every transplant patient should probably have 2 doses of MMR vaccine. They probably had 1 in childhood, but many people born between 1957 and the late 1970s may not have had a 2nd dose of MMR vaccine. So vaccinating them prior to immunosuppression is a real window of opportunity. As you know, there's the ACIP guidelines on who to vaccinate at which age, and that's helpful, I think, more in the primary care setting. I love this 2nd table, too, in the ACIP guidelines, where highlighted in red, you see immunocompromising conditions and the list of vaccines that they should get. And just to highlight that on the right-hand side, it has things like dialysis, chronic liver disease, diabetes, et cetera. So this is a very helpful chart. I use this in clinic, and you just kind of run through which vaccines are indicated. There's also an online calculator provided by the CDC in case you want an app for which vaccines are indicated for your individual patient. So tuberculosis, everybody undergoing immunosuppression should be tested for. TB, that's very straightforward across multiple different organizations. We initially saw a decline in rates of TB in 2020 at the beginning of the pandemic. But in recent times, we've seen a significant increase in tuberculosis in the country. We actually have last year, we had an 8% increase from 2023, and we currently have the highest case count since 2011. And there are multiple areas of outbreaks. So good to be on your game for that. You can see that in the international maps, this documents on the left, people who developed any form of tuberculosis with heavily enriched areas in Southeast Asia, Central Africa, Brazil. And then on the right, it's the total number of people per 100,000 population that developed any form of tuberculosis, again, higher in Africa and parts of Asia. So latent TB screening is more than just IGRA testing. You should, you know, take a history, ask epidemiologic risk factors, ask about prior skin testing. If they emigrated to the United States, did they have skin testing done at that time? And what were those results while they were, you know, healthy, et cetera? Look at the interferon gamma release assay results, look at radiographic findings. And a little clinical pearl I would provide is that it's super helpful if you're using an electronic medical record. You can search for the word granuloma, and it's amazing what you pull up. You could look for tuberculosis, but also granuloma. And I find that's helpful and can be quite revealing. So there are two different interferon gamma release assays, the T-spot TB and QuantiFERON TB Gold. These are very specific for TB antigens. They are not positive with prior BCG vaccine. And so when positive, this is usually a true positive, and they should be considered either to have active or latent tuberculosis. I get a lot of questions. If there are borderline test results, that means the test is halfway between positive and negative. But QuantiFERON can read indeterminate, and that does not mean borderline. That just means the assay did not work, so you don't know what to do with that data. So just wanted to stress that indeterminate is not borderline. Lots of questions there. So your patient has latent tuberculosis. Let's do this question I want you to answer in your mind. Should and when should you start chemoprophylaxis? When can immunosuppressive medications be started? A, start TB chemoprophylaxis ASAP as per guidelines. Ensure no active tuberculosis, pulmonary or extrapulmonary, and you can start immunosuppression anytime. B, avoid chemoprophylaxis, too much side effects and too much hassle. Or C, most of my patients had BCG vaccine as children and test false positive as older adults. I don't give TB chemoprophylaxis. Okay, so answer in your mind which one you think is best. And I would say it's A. And the important thing here is to, yes, start latent TB treatment, but you can start immunosuppression at any time. There's no data to suggest that you need to give a full course. I hear people giving recommendations, you know, give full 9 months of INH before you start rituximab. But the poor patient and clinician managing the patient are left struggling because they actually really need to start the rituximab or really need to do a life-saving organ transplant. And the other answers are just wrong. So excellent prophylaxis is paramount. And on the boards can provide important clues. So when you are reading the STEM question on the boards, if they say that people are on acyclovir, if they're on trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, they're actually telling you it's not going to be something to which that would have, for which those would have been good prevention. I will tell you that in real life, we do see breakthroughs. And so look at the prophylaxis, but don't assume 100%. But I think for the boards, you can kind of assume 100% efficacy. But real life is not the boards. Okay, so we have antivirals and then pneumocystis and toxoplasmosis and antifungals for prophylaxis. So I'll cover each of those. So CMV prevention is key after solid organ and stem cell transplant. For many of these, we give antiviral prophylaxis usually for 3 to 6 months after transplant. And that's pretty standard in the United States where many stem cell and solid organ transplants get a long period of prophylaxis. Preemptive monitoring is something that can be done with stem cell transplant patients and also organ transplant patients, but requires a certain amount of organization. So it requires weekly testing for 12 to 16 weeks. And once a certain threshold is achieved by CMV viral load, treatment is initiated. There's also this pretty cool hybrid strategy, which is doing prophylaxis for something usually like 12 weeks. It could be, you know, 3 to 6 months. And then once you stop the prophylaxis, which is when the problem starts, you do weekly testing and hopefully you capture low-level viremia, DNAemia, before it flourishes into end-organ disease and the patient ends up hospitalized. So this is a bit of belt and suspenders. You do the prophylaxis and then you do weekly monitoring and hopefully capture them before they become ill. This does require significant diagnostic burden. And we just published the 4th International Consensus Guidelines on CMV Management after Solid Organ Transplant. I will say that many experts at the meeting said that they feel they can only test every 2 weeks, but I would say that's better than not testing at all. Also, if you explain to the patient what you're doing, they may have better buy-in and more likely to go for weekly labs. There's a new agent that's been approved for kidney transplant patients, and that's letemovir. In a head-to-head study, letemovir compared to valganciclovir, this confirmed non-inferiority of letemovir versus valganciclovir. There were lower rates of leukopenia or neutropenia seen in the letemovir arm, and there were overall, interestingly, lower rates of breakthrough CMV. I'm not sure that that's what we see clinically, and lower rates of discontinuation of prophylaxis. It's not clear what dose of valganciclovir was actually given to the patients. They say it was adjusted to renal function, but that data has not been provided. And this was overall higher rates of leukopenia and neutropenia than what we've seen in other trials. So I'm a little suspicious that this was a little weighted so that letemovir was more successful, which would depend on the valganciclovir dosing. Just to emphasize that letemovir has some important drug interactions that you should know about, including with tacrolimus, cyclosporin, and azoles, and is about $271 a day versus valganciclovir that's about $117 a day. So yes, much more than twice as expensive. So if you drop that pill on the floor, dust it off and consume anyway, quite expensive. Here are the recommended approaches for CMV prevention in different organ transplant recipients. And this is what we just published. Overall, it's quite similar to prior, but we do recommend in general 3 to 6 months of prophylaxis or preemptive therapy with weekly monitoring for 12 weeks. Some of the changes have been that we now added 6 months of letemovir for high-risk donor-positive recipient negative kidney transplant recipients. And for lung transplant, we did specify that for high-risk CMV donor-positive recipient negative, we recommend 12 months of valganciclovir. And for recipient seropositive lung transplant recipients, we recommend 6 to 12 months of valganciclovir. For antiviral prophylaxis and stem cell transplant, everyone should be getting acyclovir or valacyclovir or famvir. This prevents HSV-1 and 2 and disseminated zoster. The duration varies a lot across programs, but sometimes 6 to 12 months or even 2 years, especially with a more immunosuppressive allogeneic stem cell transplant, are common durations. And then many programs are giving letemovir for 100 days if there's a higher CMV risk. And it's important to recognize that the CMV risk is opposite of organ transplant. So risk is when the bone marrow or stem cell transplant recipient is CMV positive. And so you ablate that immune system. And if you give them an immune system through the stem cell transplant that is CMV seronegative, the CMV is still in their body, but they have a naive immune system. So that's why CMV is worse in that setting. Do recognize that letemovir prevents CMV, but not HSV or zoster. It has been shown to correlate with decreased mortality after stem cell transplant. And there's something that's really important to know that might be on the boards, but letemovir, because of the mechanism of action, it's a terminase chain inhibitor, Can result in small viral load blips, so detectable CMV DNAemia. If you find one of those, and it's usually less than 1,000 IU per mil, just carry on and retest them a week later and make sure it's not worsening, like breakthrough refractory CMV. They may have low-level blips, and blips are known, well-described on letemivir, and really nothing to worry about unless it gets worse. So it's all about the trend. So just check weekly labs. The main side effect is cost, as I mentioned. Okay, here's a slide looking at antiviral prophylaxis and treatment agents. And you can see that I have listed here a variety of agents. So the new agents, letemivir and maribavir, are great for CMV only. Okay, so do remember that they only cover CMV. And in my mind, I think about using them as what I always try to think of, combination therapy, because we also probably need to cover against HSV and varicella. I usually would give letemivir and maribavir with acyclovir, famvir, valacyclovir. And we've kind of have had the life of luxury with oral valganciclovir that covers CMV, HSV, VZV. So it's been broad spectrum, but now the new therapies are single virus only therapies. So just something to try hard to remember. I think when I talk with my fellows, this is the slide that they always take a picture of with their phone. And the rest, they just nod. When should we use letemivir prophylaxis? So I do think that letemivir is very good for, this is my personal opinion, stem cell transplant recipients at high to moderate risk are clearly benefiting by letemivir. In solid organ transplant recipients who truly cannot tolerate valganciclovir, the valganciclovir is dosed perfectly. Everything seems to be going well, but perhaps they have leukopenia or maybe resistant refractory disease. So it is effective as secondary prophylaxis for that. But I do think because of cost, it's important to limit the use. And just remember, if you're using it to include something like acyclovir combination therapy. Let's talk about pneumocystis and toxoplasmosis prophylaxis. So first line therapy would be Bactrim. Bactrim is a wonder drug. It prevents so many things. We see much better outcomes. It's either Bactrim single strength daily or double strength 3 times a week. Second line therapy, which should only be used if there is a true Bactrim allergy or intolerance, would include Atovaquone 1500 milligrams once a day. Patients don't like this much. It's expensive. It tastes bad and it stains. Another therapy would be Dapsone 100 milligrams a day. Check G6PD before giving this and watch for methemoglobinemia and low white blood cell count. There are, and also like white blood cell dyscrasias. There are a lot of intolerances with Dapsone. And pentamidine once a month is also used, but does not cover toxoplasmosis. And I haven't seen it used much. The duration of for all of this is variable, but usually you want to give a minimum of 6 months after organ transplant and longer for others. Whenever possible, if patients are taken off Bactrim, do try to revisit and see if they can go back on Bactrim, because outcomes are really much better and the spectrum is much broader. So for antifungal prophylaxis, for solid organ transplant, for kidney, liver, and heart, we don't usually give very much prophylaxis. It's not really needed. Some programs give fluconazole and icatechandins around the time of liver transplant. For pancreas transplant, they often get some fluconazole because they've had to enter the small bowel, usually for less than a month. Lung transplant, because it's the only transplant that's open to the environment, often they're getting voriconazole, posaconazole, or itraconazole for variable times after transplant. Also, I should have included isavuconazole as well. And antifungal prophylaxis after stem cell transplant. So classically, fluconazole is often used in the first 100 days. It's generally for higher risk recipients. Do know that the classic is that they develop Candida krusei infections, which is resistant to fluconazole. So there's never a free lunch, right? So do know that if somebody develops a candida infection on fluconazole, you should probably, if it's a board's question, think about Candida krusei. Posaconazole is the only drug that's FDA approved for antifungal prophylaxis, but is generally reserved for higher risk patients. Voriconazole, there's been a higher risk of mucormycosis reported, and isavuconazole is not approved for prophylaxis per se, but it's often used. There are fewer drug interactions and no QT prolongation. Just some pearls on antifungal therapy that I've listed here. I think I've really moved away from using voriconazole because of the higher rates of skin cancer. With months of therapy, they do get osteitis. They can get pseudoporphyria in sunlight with horrible bubbly rashes on their hands or sun-exposed areas. It remains the best pick for initial therapy for Scedosporium infections, but does not cover mucormycosis, and there are a lot of issues around levels. So I've tended to use more isavuconazole and posaconazole. I would highlight that the posaconazole MICs for mucormycosis are better than isavuconazole. Okay, now let's switch hats and think about infection. So we talked a lot about prevention. So now, what are the sources of infection after transplant? And obviously, there's community-acquired nosocomial, prior colonization. We know that people who are colonized with Aspergillus prior to lung transplant have a much higher risk of developing invasive aspergillosis, no surprise there. There can also be emerging infections where transplant patients can be what's called the sentinel chicken, which is when there's a disease outbreak that the immunocompromised patients may be presenting first with infection. And then there can be donor-derived infection. And really important to never forget the risk of donor-derived infection. I always say transplant takes at least two. Think about, did they get a donor-derived infection from the transplant graft or from blood products? And we've had 2 decades of robust reporting of donor-derived infections in the United States. As you can see here, there are a lot of total reports, but a small number of proven and probable donor-transmitted events. The overall risk of donor-derived infections is probably about 0.2%, and all types of infections have been reported, so it's hard. We try to do excellent screening, but there's sort of an N of one or two for everything, so it's hard to do this perfectly. If you see someone who appears infected, especially in that first year after transplant, and it's not a clear-cut situation, you should trigger reporting to the local organ procurement organization so that they can check and see how the other recipients are doing. This can be life-saving. I recently had disseminated strongyloides infection in a kidney recipient. I immediately contacted the organ bank. The organ bank let other recipients know, and fortunately, the other kidney recipient was at an outside hospital. He was ill. They had no idea what he had, and they immediately treated him for strongyloides. He recovered with overall excellent health outcomes, good kidney outcomes, and they were so relieved because they said, honestly, we never would have thought about strongyloides. So just that one phone call can be life-saving. There are examples of transfusion-transmitted infections in solid organ transplant recipients. Here you can see the infectious agents, West Nile, yellow fever vaccine virus, HIV, and Chagas disease transmitted through blood products. So think about donor-derived infections. Think about transfusion-transmitted infections, which I think infectious disease specialists don't always think about. Okay, let's switch now to various syndromes. So CMV is the most common pathogen after transplant, and it is one of the great masqueraders. Mostly we see it as asymptomatic viremia, but we can see CMV syndrome and end organ disease, including colitis, pneumonitis, retinitis. The best diagnostic is CMV viral load testing. Serology has no use in the setting of acute diagnostics. It is best treated with oral valganciclovir or intravenous ganciclovir, and we usually do weekly blood checks until resolution of infection. Here's an outline of how we treat CMV at my hospital. Most patients have mild to moderate disease. Most are treated with oral valganciclovir, but if they have severe life-threatening, sight-threatening disease or horrible diarrhea such that you're worried about malabsorption, we usually admit for intravenous ganciclovir. We think about lowering the immunosuppression. I usually talk to their transplant clinician. And if they have hypogammaglobulinemia, sometimes we replete. more if they have clinically significant disease, but we often will replete with CMV immunoglobulin. We check weekly CMV PCR or viral load, or what is technically called DNAemia, on plasma. And just once they have, we treat them until they have one or two negative or very low, defined as less than 200 IU per mil results, and then we stop therapy. If the CMV DNAemia doesn't fall after 2 to 3 weeks, we then send resistance testing. Don't send it at week one. A good teaching about CMV is that the level will often go up at week one and then fall by week two. And that's why we talk about DNAemia, because you're actually just amplifying DNA in the bloodstream. And then if people have profound immunosuppression or low absolute lymphocyte count, we often recommend monitoring after the end of treatment or giving them secondary prophylaxis until their absolute lymphocyte count or net state of immunosuppression has improved. So there are a lot of very low CMV viral load cases, so less than 500 to 1,000 IU per mil on plasma or whole blood. Treatment is not always indicated. I see a lot of people chasing very low test results. This is real-time PCR. I don't really worry too much below 200 and certainly below 500. I don't worry much other than in D plus R minus, where it would be good to initiate treatment. Do think about risk factors for severe infection, net state of immunosuppression. What is the likelihood disease will flare while waiting? And can we do repeat testing? With all low testing, I think I generally just check again in a week, and so that we can know the trend of infection, and a lot of it goes away. There's a huge practice variation, and we've addressed this in the updated guidelines, and I'm hoping that there's a lot less overtreatment of very low test results. Maribavir is the new guy on the block to treat resistant refractory disease. It was shown to be to have much better clearance at 56% after 8 weeks of treatment versus 24% in investigator-assigned therapy, which was sort of standard of care and better tolerated. And because it's pills, they don't need admission to the hospital. So overall, good outcomes. But we are seeing significant rates of resistance in a quarter to half of patients who get maribavir. So use cautiously. We do have an updated algorithm in the CMV guidelines that are just published last week. For people that have high viral load or end organ disease and resistant refractory disease, we actually do recommend use of foscarnet for induction followed by maribavir for consolidation because of the higher rate of developing resistance. We recommend sending genotyping and then using the genotyping to direct further therapy. And I think if you have a case of resistant refractory disease, I'd recommend you use this algorithm, which was beautifully developed by Dr. Sunwin Cho from Oregon. Okay, let's talk about the dreaded pulmonary nodule. For the boards in clinical medicine, consider the prophylaxis, as I mentioned, and what's not covered. And let the prophylaxis and epidemiology drive your differential diagnosis. So who gets fungal infections? It's significant rate after solid organ and stem cell transplant, and it is something that we really worry about. Diagnostics can include culture, fungal stain and culture. Notify the lab to not mince the specimen if you are suspicious of mucor mycosis. We write rule out mucor so that they know to not dice it, mince it. And fungal isolators are very rarely positive. We've moved away from these. Candida will grow in routine blood cultures. For histoplasmosis, it is better to use fungal isolators. But in general, you don't need to send fungal isolators. And then pathology, morphology can be very helpful along with special stains. So I always say have a good relationship with your pathologist, and that will enhance your diagnostics. There are a variety of fungal markers that are used for diagnosis of invasive fungal dissection, including pulmonary nodules. I will say my personal favorite is still cryptococcal antigen, high sensitivity specificity. When that guy's positive, you have a good answer. 1,3-beta-D-glucan for me is not useful other than I think it has low sensitivity, moderate specificity. We see a lot of false positives. It is excellent for diagnosis of pneumocystis, especially for people who are too sick for bronchoscopy, but for whom you have a high clinical and radiographic suspicion. So I think 1,3 beta D-glucan is good in that scenario. And otherwise, I do not send it, although it is sent by many people who consult me. Galactomannan on body fluids, good sensitivity, but not very good on blood, rarely positive. And Aspergillus PCR, I would say similar. I would highlight there's a publication that just came out this month in CID on Carius, the cell-free DNA test to identify and quantify fungal pathogens, uses shotgun metagenomic sequencing. And the paper that was published showed a higher sensitivity with proven versus probable disease at 60% versus 37%. It is really expensive to send a carrier, so we are not sending this on a regular basis, but it may become the way of the future, and certainly is nice to know what fungal species you're dealing with, et cetera. Again, I can't emphasize enough, don't put too much weight on the beta-D-glucan and galactomannan on blood. I hear a lot of people stopping antifungal therapy or whatever because they're not positive, but I really don't think they're very useful. Here's a great slide on the antifungal mechanism of action. This was published by Zoe Weiss, Jess Little, and Sarah Hammond. And I don't want to go into all the details of the antifungal mechanisms of action, but what I loved here was seeing all the different agents, where they work. And then in red, you can see all the antifungals that are in various states of development or recent release. But the, you know, when would you give orlorafem? When would you use abrexafungerp, rezafungin, et cetera? So I find this to be quite helpful. Okay, so clinical cases. 54-year-old woman with a history of primary systemic AL amyloid, complicated by cardiac amyloid. She was treated with Cytoxan, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, followed by lenalidomide and dexamethasone. She underwent heart transplant. And the plan was 5 months later to have her undergo autologous stem cell transplant to treat the amyloid. Her CMV viral load on day zero of her transplant was 29,000, so that's not good. It should have been checked beforehand, but it was not. And then she developed neutropenic sepsis with strep salivarius on day five. And on day 18, she was noted to have a 2-centimeter pulmonary nodule. There you can see the pulmonary nodule. So, you know, the question is, what is it? After ordering bronchoscopy, what should be your next step? And should you start voriconazole, start posaconazole, or isavuconazole? Should you start amphotericin? Should you start an icatechandin? Or should you do combination therapy? And so I'll let you think about what you would probably do. And I would say that I think the best answers are posaconazole or isavuconazole, start amphotericin or combination therapy. My practice is to start AmBisome until I know what I'm dealing with because it is the broadest. I get a lot of flack. I know nobody likes the, you know, they're concerned about kidneys and whatnot, but a few days of AmBisome, I do not regret. She has a dry cough, but denies any sputum production. She felt well. She wanted to go home. Voriconazole was started. So voriconazole was started. That wasn't one of our picks. She underwent bronchoscopy and non-septate hyphae were seen. So that's going to be mucormycosis, likely zygomycetes. She was switched to isavuconazole and AmBisome. And 2 days later, she had increasing pulmonary nodules with satellite lesions, and she had a right lower lobe resection that evening with the cardiothoracic surgeons. There's a picture of the resection. There's a picture of the pathology with these wide non-septate hyphae. Looks very ominous. She grew rhizopus, and we stopped the AmBisome and continued her on long-term isavuconazole. We thought that we had clean margins, but we wanted to be very careful. She did well, and we eventually stopped therapy. A year after transplant, she didn't want to take her acyclovir. It was very independent. And she presented with disseminated zoster. She had new patchy infiltrates that responded well to intravenous intravenous acyclovir. So a happy story overall, and I will be forever thankful to the cardiothoracic surgeon who was willing to take her to the operating room that day to resect pulmonary mucor because it saved her life. She's a farmer in Vermont and has really thrived, and I'm so glad. Okay, here's another pulmonary lesion. This is a patient with multiple myeloma who had years of multiple myeloma, underwent autologous stem cell transplant in March of 2019. He had disease progression, and he was on a clinical trial and had CAR T cell therapy in 2021. He was on fluconazole and acyclovir prophylaxis. And a PET CT scan, as you can see, showed a new thick-walled, multiloculated cavitary lesion in the right upper lobe with surrounding glaringoglass and clustered nodularity, concerning for infection as well as typical bacterial and atypical and fungal pathogens in an immunocompromised patient. So what is this? Well, the epidemiology from the ID fellow note highlighted things like he had been dirt biking and hiking, likes to walk outside, works as a contractor for the Department of Defense. He'd been to Australia, nothing too high risk. So what would you do next? Would you start voriconazole, start what we call vancomycin, vancomycin plus cefepime? Would you start azithromycin? Would you do all of the above or bronchoscopy? So I would do the bronchoscopy because we really need a diagnosis. And lo and behold, this showed Pseudomonas. Everything else was negative. And this is just a complex Pseudomonas infection. I have to say, I've been fooled again and again by this pathogen where I really thought something was a mold, but it turned out to be Pseudomonas. Here's another patient, 45-year-old man, heart transplant 3 months earlier. He's on posaconazole, prophylaxis, and etobicoke. He has a new pneumonia, right middle lobe. What is the cause? And lo and behold, nocardia nova, classic. So because he's on etobicoke, not on trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, we do see a lot of breakthrough nocardia. We also see breakthrough nocardia in patients on Bactrim. So it looks like trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole prophylaxis isn't perfect for nocardia prevention. Probably helps some, but not all. Let's switch to parasites. I do want to say for toxoplasmosis can be one of the more wily pathogens out there. We used to see a much higher percent of the U.S. population having had prior toxoplasmosis exposure at 23% of younger folks being infected in the late 80s and 90s. And in more recent times, this has dropped to about 10% of the population. So if you're seeing older folks, they are much more likely to have been infected with toxo. We see syndromes after transplant, including encephalitis, pneumonitis, myocarditis, and chorioretinitis. And, you know, serology is useful for risk assessment, but not for diagnosing active disease. And I'd just like to emphasize how helpful toxoplasmosis PCR on blood, CSF, and bronchoscopy or tissue can be. And some programs do this as routine monitoring in specific stem cell transplant recipients. So that's a good one to stick in your pocket, the toxo PCR. And I'm always happy to have that guy, especially when it's positive. Here's another 64-year-old man from the Dominican Republic, end-stage liver disease, chronic abdominal pain listed for liver transplant. He's had eosinophilia up to 70% for 6 months. He has recurrent enteric gram-negative rods bacteremia that were billed as recurrent cholecystitis. Fluffy pulmonary infiltrates are noted. So what does he have? He has a positive strongyloides antibody. He has disseminated strongylidiasis. It's a roundworm. Hundreds of millions of people worldwide are infected. There's an autoinfection loop. And so this can reactivate. And we do see a lot of reactivation. Anyone from areas in yellow or red or orange on this map should be screened, although it's not everyone in the United States, not the best map. But anyone kind of from the warmer climate should probably have a strongylitis antibody. And just to highlight the life cycle, there's this autoinfection loop, so it can stay alive in a human for decades. I put it in my mind as sort of like tuberculosis, things that can reactivate. I want to emphasize the importance of diagnostic stewardship. So I do hear people. One of the residents recently said to me, a surgical resident said, "Dr. Cotton, I clicked everything infectious disease that I could find." Okay, so that's not really the best approach, and it's very expensive. think about the best methods to achieve your most likely diagnosis. So you've talked to the patient, done a physical exam, you know, you've honed in on what you think it is. So do try to achieve something, you know, like Occam's razor, thinking about what diagnosis is most likely to fit the entire clinical picture. I would emphasize that Hickam's dictum, where patients can have as many diseases as they darn well please, can apply to transplant patients. So sometimes it's more than one thing is happening. The initial workup can be protocol driven. We have syndromic evaluations in the emergency room that tend to work pretty well, you know, for a transplant patient coming in with urinary symptoms or diarrhea or pneumonia. Molecular diagnostics are generally superior, but do require us to be specific in our requests. Things like the multiplex PCR testing can be helpful, although we can sometimes be a bit lazy, but we have to think, is there anything that's going to be missed by multiplex? Non-invasive fungal diagnostics, as I mentioned, have been disappointing. Toxo-PCR can be helpful, although certainly I don't send it very much, but I think about it more as a second-line test. Cell-free DNA testing is interesting, as I mentioned, expensive. But the sooner we achieve a diagnosis and the sooner we can stop broad-spectrum antibiotics and really hone in on treatment, the better the overall outcomes for the patient. So diagnostic stewardship is both a challenge of you want to send enough testing, you want to nail the diagnosis, you want to do it fairly quickly, but you don't want to send the kitchen sink. I'd like to highlight, we did just recently have an interesting case where a middle-aged kidney transplant patient came in with fever. She had an extensive workup. We'd done a big workup. We had no answer. We convinced the lab, which controls if we can send carriers. We sent the cell-free DNA tests, and 2 days later, the test returned positive for tuberculosis. We were shocked. She had no TB risk factors. Subsequently, over the next few days, Mycobacterium tuberculosis grew from her blood, urine, BAL, and bone marrow. So we didn't really need carious, but it did expedite the diagnosis and initiation of treatment, and she did overall quite well. For the boards, really important to know about drug interactions with transplant medications and antimicrobials. Almost for sure, they love to ask questions about the azole. So voriconazole and posaconazole, more than fluconazole, have profound drug interactions with tacrolimus, cyclosporin, and rapamycin. When we are starting voriconazole and posaconazole, we usually recommend dose reduction of tacrolimus by about 70%. For fluconazole, we recommend dose reduction of tacrolimus by about 50%. Isavuconazole does not have much of an interaction. Rifamycins are the opposite. So you won't get tacrolimus toxicity. You will get potentially, I think of it as organ rejection. So when I start like TB treatment, I think I'm going to cause organ rejection by profoundly decreasing tacrolimus or cyclosporin or rapamycin levels. You can also double the metabolism of prednisone. So when you start a rifamycin, you usually should double the prednisone dose. You can have QT prolongation, and that's something to really be concerned about. QT prolongation can be pre-existing with liver disease, and definitely use an online drug interaction calculator or one of your amazing pharmacists who can be just so incredible and really enhance our care, as I'm sure everyone would agree. Let's talk briefly about turning a no into a yes. Many people say to me, oh, you must tell transplant patients to not do a lot of stuff. Actually, that's not my goal. My goal is to get them to live happy, healthy, full lives. And how can I do that? How can I say yes to a higher risk transplant donor and save lives? I do that all the time. How can we render a candidate who's too sick for transplant into transplant eligible? You know, let's carefully review, how can we optimize? How can I get them to have a healthy return to work and school on immunosuppression? How can they undergo foreign travel? I'd spend a lot of time doing travel after transplant with them. Things like having a healthy sex life on immunosuppression and safe gardening. And these are all areas where infectious disease specialists can contribute a lot to the transplant teams. And I'm really happy that so many people are able to live very full lives with excellent health. There are a lot of guidelines out there. We will have updated guidelines from the American Society of Transplantation later this year. I mentioned the updated CMV guidelines for solid organ transplant. The European stem cell transplant guidelines have recently been published, and the American version will come out later this year. So just in summary, the cardinal rules of transplant for immunosuppression and infection. It's not always straightforward. Be prepared to be surprised. Think broadly, but also think about common things. Prepare your patient before immunosuppression. There's a great role for infectious disease specialists. I usually do a one-and-done visit, but it really helps prevent infection and also helps get the patient emotionally and educationally ready for transplant. Prophylaxis and vaccines greatly alter the risk equation and decrease the overall risk of infection. And think about the sources of infection, which can be varied, including donor-derived, recipient-derived, blood product-derived, geographic, and higher rates of antimicrobial resistance. Thanks a lot for your attention.